Now, for those of you all who are here, you can see behind me that we are continuing this Sunday in looking at our refutation of evolution. And so far in this series, we have looked at three things that stand in opposition to the thought of Darwinian evolution. Now, the first of these was to look at the mathematical probability of life arising spontaneously from non-life. Life from non-life. Science, at this point, can still not even make life from that which is dead already, that has all the right components. But yet the theory of evolution starts with all the necessary elements of life being randomly made and then somehow randomly coming together in a very ordered arrangement, and then all of the metabolic processes beginning, all going on by chance, and then that living cell would have to have the mechanism to duplicate itself and to create more cells. So there's a lot there. And, you know, to most of you all, you probably, just the thought of that all kind of sounds absurd. It certainly does to me. I mean, after all, if you had a junkyard with all of the necessary components to build a car, and they were setting in a circle, you could come back a million years later and you would not find a car made from those parts. It just wouldn't happen. All you would find is rust and rot and decay. We looked at the mathematical probability, as did the biochemist at MIT, that said the chance of a cell forming like that was the equivalent of finding a single specific atom in all of the known universe. So simply put, impossible. Now, last week we looked at two more things. The first thing we looked at was mutations, which is the change of genetic structure that can be passed to an offspring. We mentioned that most mutations aren't neither good nor bad, but out of the two, the chance that there would be a bad mutation would be about 80% of the time compared to the small amount of time that a good mutation would take place. Evolution hangs its hat on those good mutations. And we looked at three types of mutations. The first two types, they happen all of the time, but they do not ever cause a change in a organism. That is, a new organism is never created. A bird may gain a bigger beak or a smaller beak, but it's still a bird. As a matter of fact, a finch is still a finch. And mice are still mice. Some might have black fur, some might have white fur, but they're still mice. And we looked at E. coli, and we said even though E. coli may receive genetic material from another bacteria and make it antibiotic resistance, it's still E. coli. It does not change itself into a new organism. Now, the third type of mutation, though, that was positive mutation, would require a large amount of genetic information that would lead, basically, to a new organism being created. That is basically leaping from an eel to a snake. That is, an eel that could grow legs and then crawl up on the land or something like that. This type of mutation has never been observed. Ever been observed. As a matter of fact, scientists can't even come up with a theory to consider how all this new genetic information could be suddenly amassed within the genetic code of the organism. As I said, you know, if you have legs that are going to sprout out, you've also got to have the genetic structure for bones, muscles, nerves, all the things that go along with it. And it has never been observed. I didn't mention this last time, but it is notable to consider as well. But when scientists look at the rate of degeneration of the human genome, now what do we mean by that? Because there are more bad mutations going on than good mutations, the human genome is actually getting more corrupt. There's more mutations today than there ever has been. So when we look at the degradation of the human genome, what scientists observe is that we should be extinct as a population if we are as old as what science often says that we are. Dr. John Samford, a geneticist at Cornell, has gone on record saying that humans could not be any older than 100,000 years at best, and some estimate those rates at being lower because of the rate of genetic mutation. Then lastly and briefly, we looked at the fossil record. The fossil record shows a great diversity of life that has already become extinct. What the fossil record, though, has never revealed is the intermediates that would be necessary for evolution to take place. That is, we don't find fish with legs. We don't find animals with partial wings. Those things would elate an evolutionist to find those missing links. But in the fossil record, we find none. Now, as we mentioned last time, in order for fossils to be formed, they must be formed in such a way that a rapid burial has to take place. Something cataclysmic must take place, like a rock slide, a sudden flood, a tar pit explosion, volcano explosion. Something of that nature has to rapidly bury and compress material. Fossils are not made by things that just fall to the earth. So a random animal that dies and falls to the earth, a fossil will not be made. Now, since there are massive amounts of fossils found all over the earth, numerous attempts have tried to describe how these could have occurred, including multiple cataclysmic world events. But young earth scientists, and there are young earth scientists, believe that the fossil record was created primarily by one major cataclysmic global event, and that is the flood. The flood that we find in the book of Genesis and the subsequent ice age that took place shortly after that. Today, what I want to do is look at evidence for a biblical flood. And at first, that may not seem like much of a refutation of evolution. But remember, evolution stands in stark contrast to the Genesis account of mankind that we find in the Word of God. So we're going to look at evidence for, indeed, the flood. Now, we do have a business meeting scheduled, and we have actually a lot to talk about today. So we are going to try to keep things on the shorter side as well. If you would, turn with me to the book of Genesis in chapter 6. The book of Genesis in chapter 6. And we're going to pick up our reading in verse number 9. Genesis 6, beginning our reading in verse number 9. It says here, "These are the generations of Noah, and Noah was a just man and perfect in his generations, and Noah walked with God. And Noah begat three sons, Shem, Ham, and Japheth. The earth was also corrupt before God, and the earth was filled with violence. And God looked upon earth, and behold, it was corrupt, for all flesh had corrupted his way upon the earth. And God said unto Noah, The end of all flesh has come before me, for the earth is filled with violence through them. And behold, I will destroy the earth. Make thee an ark of gopher wood. Rooms shalt thou make in the ark, and shalt pitch it within and without with pitch. And this is the fashion which thou shalt make of it. The length of the ark shall be 300 cubits, the breadth of it 50 cubits, the height of it 30 cubits. And we're going to stop our reading there. But what we have here from the very beginning is a historical type of recording. We have the presentation of Noah, his three sons, Shem, Ham, and Japheth. Important names to know for even a little bit later on in our discussion. We see here the beginning as well in verse number 15, the beginning of instructions of how to construct the ark. It was important for the ark to be constructed in the manner that it was. It has been said that the dimensions of the ark are compatible with normal ship building. It wasn't, you know, some odd-shaped thing. The dimensions aren't kind of crazy in nature. They are what a normal ship would be built like. The structure, indeed, was massive. For some of you all who went to the ark, when we went up to look at that, that was one of the things. Of course, that ark probably didn't look anything like the ark that Noah built, but the size of it was equal. And just the massiveness of it was something else. But it was massive for truly a purpose. Before we read in verse 19 and following, "And of every living thing of all flesh, two of every sort shalt thou bring into the ark to keep them alive with thee. Thou shalt be male and female. Of fowls after their kind, and of cattle after their kind, of every creeping thing of the earth after his kind, two of every sort shall come unto thee to keep them alive." The boat, the ark, was meant to be a safe house to preserve life upon this earth during the global flood that was to come. And by the way, the flood indeed was global in nature. Were it not global in nature, God would have just told Noah to go to some other place, right? Go up to Mount of Ararat and bring the animals there. Could have saved a lot of time in the process of building this ark. But instead, God told him to build this ark for the saving of his family and those animals in which God would bring to the ark. Now, look with me briefly in chapter 7. Briefly in chapter 7, verses 11 and 12. We read here, "In the 600th year of Noah's life, in the second month, the 17th day of the month, the same day were all the fountains of the great deep broken up, and the windows of heaven were opened. And the rain was upon the earth 40 days and 40 nights. Now, I want you to notice some important things here. First of all, we see the continuation of what appears to be a very historical narrative. We have listed for us here a recording of the exact day that the flood took place. We have a recording of how many days that it rained, and not just are we told how many days that it rained, but as we look on, we see how long that the waters prevailed upon the earth. And then we see how long it took for the waters to recede upon the earth. How long they stayed in the ark after the flood waters receded. It is all recorded down to the very day that it took place. What you are reading does not sound anything like a fanciful story. It sounds like an historical record of something that took place. And we believe, of course, that it did. Now, secondly, and this is very important here, you'll see in these verses that we just read that it did not only just rain upon the earth for 40 days, but you'll see here in these verses that the fountains of the deep, the fountains of the deep were broken up. That is, as globally we have water spewing out from up underneath the crust of the earth. And this was truly a cataclysmic type of event. Here we have many animals that are killed and buried very rapidly in nature that would account for the fossil records that have been shown. And then after the flood, the shift in the earth's environment, from what used to be a very warm environment, of course, seemed to start the ice age and the things that would follow with that. Now, the fact of the matter is, the scientists on both sides debate about what we see geologically. And could it have happened, indeed, with the Earth's shifting and global flood that took place? Or were these things very smaller, or much smaller cataclysmic events that took place consistently over time. Geologically, young earth scientists have a lot on their side, such as the rate of soil erosion when it comes to rivers and looking at the deposits and the deltas. There's a lot of things that point to the earth being indeed not billions of years old, but thousands in nature instead. But when it comes to the flood, since looking at the geological evidence from what I've been able to tell is more like a he said, she said type of argument, what I want to do is just look at some historical proofs to show indeed that the events of Noah and his family were indeed true events. Because if they were true events, then it leads credence to the flood itself. So, first of all, we want to consider just the story of the flood itself. Just the story of the flood itself. Most scientists today would believe, indeed, and many people do, Christians as well, sometimes believe that the flood, Noah and the flood, is nothing more than a religious myth. But let's consider the elements of Noah being told by God to build an ark for the saving of his family and the saving of creatures, these animals. Is there evidence of that story, that thought line, that process in other cultures? Now, why do we say that? Because shortly after the flood, we know that instead of man going and dispersing themselves upon the earth, as the command of God was, they began to settle, right? And they began to settle specifically in one area around a place we call Babel, where there was a tower that was being built and God dispersed them from there. Now, even if they had neglected God, the true God, which we know that they did, certainly there at Babel, but as they began to disperse, the story of the flood was so impressive, would it be totally forgotten? Well, the answer seems to be no. Many traditions around the world of ancient people describe in one form or another the account of a worldwide flood in which only a few people were saved. They have found fragments from the 19th century B.C., an ancient Babylonia, that describe a flood that was sent to destroy mankind, but one god chose a king to build a giant ship to preserve a few people. The Assyrian accounts found in Nineveh are the same, are some of the most famous that we know. It's the story of Gilgamesh and how he was advised of God to build a boat for the saving of his family, animals, and even describes the sending forth of birds at the very end of the story. The Greeks tell the story of how Zeus decided to destroy man, but a fellow, and I'm going to say this his name wrong, no doubt, but Deucleon was advised by Prometheus to build an ark where he and his wife stay until the flood is over and they come to rest upon a mountaintop. The Romans in their culture had a very similar tale. The flood is also mentioned in Sanskrit, which is India. The story there is a man by the name of Manu, who was told by a fish to build a boat to survive a flood that was coming to destroy the earth. And, of course, that boat came to rest upon a mountaintop. The Mandi people of Mali in Central Africa tell a creation type of story, where an ark landed on a mountain with eight people and carried out the first animals and plants. The Aborigines of Northern Australia have a dreamtime story of creation gone wrong, where the gods cleansed the earth by a flood. Other cultures as well, from Eskimos to American Indians to Mayans, all seem to have different flood accounts. There's even flood accounts in China in Southern Asia. Now, why do I mention these things? Certainly we know that the accounts are different from place to place. Some say one thing, some of these different characters, but most they have some common things about them. The saving of life through people, the saving of animals, some mention rainbows, some mention the landing on the mountains, many similarities to the Genesis account. But when we look at those other accounts, they're also very fanciful in nature as well. Floods seem to last for only 7 days. The boat structure isn't anything that would be seaworthy type of things. Out of all of those, Genesis gives a clear, concise history of how those things could take place, giving a boat with the right kind of structure to carry out those things, and records it down to the day. You know, one can even understand how, as the story of the flood, you know, you remember in school when you used to do that thing where you're talking somebody's ear and you come out and isn't exactly what you start off with? You think about that as people spread out from place to place. You can almost see how that story could get altered and changed along the way. But the Genesis account is the clear forerunner of them all. So the first piece of the puzzle attesting to the global flood and subsequent events is seemingly a universal story of such an event taking place. Now, what I'd like to do is consider place names. This is something I really never thought about before until I started looking at this, and it seems like an odd way of looking at support for the flood, but remember that after the flood, the Bible gives us the descendants of Noah through his sons, Shem, Ham, and Japheth, right? Now, I'm from Wayne. This church is in the county of Wayne. And Wayne was named for a real man. It was named for a guy by the name of Matt Anthony Wayne. You can look him up on the internet and you can read all about him. What I'm trying to get at is the names of places come from real people, whether it is sometimes in honor of that person or by a person who started there or first person who lived there. You know, oftentimes you go up these roads and you'll see a place like Dameron Branch or something like that. It's based upon the families that lived there, the farms that were there. Fictitious people do not build cities, do they? They just don't. So by looking at place names and seeing the correlation to the descendants of Noah, that puts again credibility to the Genesis account and the dispersion of people. So let's start with one that just kind of surprised me right off the bat. Egypt. That is the country of Egypt, or as it used to be called, the land of Egypt. The word Egypt actually comes to us from Greek. Did y'all know that? Because I didn't. That's Greek. It is a translation of the word Mizraim. Mizraim. Sometimes on Egyptian maps, it's listed, instead of Egypt, you'll see the word M-I-S-R spelled out. That's the national name for Egypt. That's what they call themselves. Well, in Genesis 10:6, you will find the second son of Ham listed, and his name is Mizraim. Mizraim. His descendants populated the land of Egypt. One Egyptian historian by the name of Manetho, in 270 B.C., recorded in these words, kind of, you know, I'm translating to English here. After the flood, Ham, the son of Noah, begat Aegyptus, or Mizraim, who was the first to establish the area when the tribes dispersed. Now, what was he talking about when the tribes dispersed? He's talking about the Tower of Babylon. As a matter of fact, he even gave a date to this dispersion as 5 years after the birth of Peleg. So Egypt gets its name from Noah's grandson. Greece is another example. Over in Greece, they call themselves the son of Javan. This was another grandson of Noah, born to Japheth. If you were a Hebrew person, instead of calling Greece, Greece, you'd call it Javan. That's what they call Greece. The Greeks trace their origin of the human race back to a man named Japetus, who is probably Japheth, again, according to the Genesis account. Japheth had other sons. One was named Magog, which correlates to an area in southern Russia and Ukraine. He had another son by the name of Medea, whose descendants became known as the Medes. The fact that these countries and areas find root in the names of the grandsons of Noah attests to the person of Noah and the historical account that describes it all. Now, the last thing I want to mention is that the timing of these kingdoms lines up with the biblical account of the dispersion of people as well. We already mentioned that the Egyptian historian Manetho dated the origins of Egypt back to Peleg and the dispersion of the people. Over in Genesis in chapter 10, verse 25, it says, "And unto Eber were born two sons. The name of one was Peleg, for in his days the earth was divided, and his brother's name was Joktan." The dividing of the people, the dispersion of the people, was there at the Tower of Babel. By the way, what do you think eventually where the Tower of Babel was at, that land was called? Babylon. Babel became Babylon. But there is a timeline that develops in the Bible for the mass migration of people that is taking place. Now, speaking of Babylon, one of the things that the people of Babylon were known for was the studying of stars, looking into the heavens and recording those observations. And they would record those observations on bricks. When those were discovered, the dates that those observations began to be recorded are 2233 B.C., which is consistent with the founding of Babylon and Babel, according to the Genesis account. When you look at Greece, which we mentioned a few minutes ago, the 4th century historian dates the first Greek king to 2089, which would have been about 100 years after Babylon, and certainly is consistent with the migration of a group of people from Babylon to that area. Even the oldest preserved Chinese chronologies, known as the Bamboo Annals, give the date of the first Chinese dynasty starting about 2183 B.C., which again is consistent with people moving from Babylon to China. Now, there are some people that ask the question, well, what about the races? Right? What about races? How do we get races if they're all coming from these same group of people? Is it possible that the races could be traced back to 8 people, or really 6 people, following the flood? So we're not told of Noah and his wife having any more children. Well, I'm going to do one better for you, because the Bible tells us that all of the earth's population came from 2 people. Their names were Adam and Eve. All the races of earth are from one blood. It's really astonishing when you think about it. You know, if the Bible weren't true, when the Hebrew came in contact with the first black man, they would have considered themselves to have nothing in common. Same was true with somebody that looked Asian or something of that nature. They would have given a different description of how those things could have taken place. But the Bible says we all started from just one. But that said, the right genetic combination of those upon the ark would have produced all the races of the earth, or could have caused all the races on the earth in just a matter of a few generations. Now, we're going to stop there for today because we do need to move on to the business meeting. Next week, we're going to start with 1 Timothy. There are some future lessons I'd like to do that kind of continue on this thought, things with radiometric dating. But I really want to get back in the Word of God and focus on 1 Timothy here. In the end, though the evidence historically, as we've looked at it today, let's just kind of review here. You know, as we look at what we've studied so far, the probability of evolution doesn't seem possible. The mutation of scenario, never been observed. Historically, the Bible seems to be validated through the timelines and the stories that we hear. I believe that evolutionary science is at a loss, a complete loss. I believe that there is a better way to describe how life all started upon this earth. And it begins with the words, "In the beginning, God created the heaven and the earth." We're going to go ahead and dismiss in prayer here. As we dismiss in prayer, we're also going to pray for the business meeting that is to follow. And we're going to go directly into that business meeting. If you would, let's bow our heads.